Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here. Friday interview a dish in the studio here at Pond City Market. And I had a great chat just now with Ike Barinholtz, everybody. He, I'm delighted to say, is, and I know I say this all the time, the nicest dude and so funny and so fun to talk to about Goodfellas, which was his pick. But Ike, you might know from... Boy, he's been around. He's been a lot of things. He's got one of those faces where you see it and you're like, that's Ike Barinholtz. He was in, well, the first thing I think I saw him in was Mad TV. He was a cast member for 5 or 6 years. And then Eastbound and Down, one of my favorite shows. We talk about it in this, in our talk here. He was, he played Ivan the Russian pitcher and nemesis of Kenny Powers in that great, great TV show. And you might know his work from The Mindy Project. And he has a brand new movie coming out that he wrote and directed and stars in with his brother John and the wonderful Tiffany Haddish. And Nora Dunn is in it. And just a really, really great cast. It's called The Oath. And it comes out October 12th. And I got to see it because we were going to do a little Q&A screening in Atlanta last night. But his plane was delayed, so he couldn't make it. But the good news is I got to see the movie as a result. And it's very, very funny. It's very dark. Dark comedy, everybody. Dark satire, which is one of my favorite genres, and he really goes there. It's about a man sort of obsessed with the current presidential administration in the film, fictional presidential administration, wherein that president has asked the citizens of the United States to sign an oath of loyalty to prove how much they love him. So a family Thanksgiving ensues that is funny, and then it gets very dark, but it stays funny, and he strikes just the right tone. It's a very funny, funny movie, and I highly recommend you see it out October 12th, The Oath. So Ike came in, he picked Goodfellas, which I was very grateful for because it's one of my favorite movies of all time, and we had a really good time talking about not only Goodfellas, but his career in acting and comedy and improv, and even a little bit about 80s NBA basketball. So how about that? So here we go with the wonderful Ike Barinholtz on Goodfellas. Oh, yeah.
NPR voice.
That's why I can't tell. I've never looked her up.
Yeah,
I've resisted
she's,
the urge.
She's older.
Okay.
She's older. She's no spring chicken, but neither am I for that matter.
What part of Chicago?
I was born in Rogers Park, which is kind of like it's almost like the northern tip of the city. And then we moved to Uptown. We moved to Uptown when I was like six, like mm-hmm. not too far from Wrigley Field.
Are you a Cubs fan?
Big time.
Yeah.
How about you, Braves? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
We might see you guys in the playoffs.
Yeah, they. I don't know how much you keep up with it, but they moved the Braves out of the city.
Yeah,
into the suburbs.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago.
That sucks when that happens.
And it's not like I bailed on the team, but like I used to go a lot.
Well, it's
games.
Right downtown. It's like Wrigley Field. It's right there.
Yeah,
so, yeah. It's tough.
Once so it's the... been a bit of a bummer.
Yeah.
Chicago is one of my favorite places. So.
It's the best. Man. I love it.
Fucking awesome.
I love it.
Great food. Well, I've been there a few times to do, like, live Stuff You Should Know shows. It's
sure.
another podcast
right.
that I do. And went last year for that U2 Joshua Tree show.
Okay.
At Soldier Field.
Soldier Field, right.
Because he didn't play Atlanta. And my wife and I were like, I feel like we should go to this. Let's just pick a city. And Chicago is
the right
no-brainer.
City to go. It's the right city to go see a show.
It's so much fun, though, man.
I love it.
It's a great town.
I'm going back a week from Monday. I can't wait.
Do you have family
sure,
there?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we're having a screening of the movie there.
Oh, cool.
And we're like, I put it on Facebook, and like every person I've ever met is like, I would love to come and bring five people. And I'm like, well, how about you just bring your wife? And we'll
great.
Figure it out. Yeah, I'm really excited. I booked an improv show right afterwards. I'm kind of kicking myself for that because I would love just to finish the movie and like have a drink. But instead,
right.
I'm going to go schlep over to the theater and do a fucking improv show. So it's going to be
Second City
At IO Improv
okay.
Olympic. That's kind of more my theater. So.
Gotcha.
And luckily, it's close to that, so it shouldn't be too bad.
So IO, they have one, or they did in LA, right? Did they still
closed down
right.
about 6 months ago? And then last week, big LA Times story that. SWAT raided it last week, and they found it had been taken over by squatters who were dealing guns and drugs.
Was that on Cosmo?
Yeah, Cosmo in Hollywood. Exactly. Okay, no one knows that. They're always like Cahuenga, right? But you know Cosmo.
Well, because we have an LA studio on Cosmo, and last time I was there, which was a few months ago, there was some kind of raid going on Cosmo.
That was probably like a pre-raid or something. Yeah.
A run-through?
It was a run-through. It was a dress rehearsal. Were they doing it not quite right, but you could tell?
Yeah, well, and all the drug dealers inside were like, am I okay?
What are we doing here, guys? How far do we want to go with this? Are we rolling?
Yeah, we're recording.
Great. Oh, awesome.
So this is all, I'll just find a good entry point.
I love it.
Well, let's talk about The Oath.
Have you seen it?
Yes. I was so ready to talk about this at the Q&A last night.
Can we just take a few minutes and talk about United Airlines? look, weather is weather, but you don't have to be rude. And you don't have to make people go to the wrong gate twice. It was a disaster. But, yeah, that would have been fun.
Yeah, just so everyone knows, Ike was in town yesterday. There was a screening of The Oath. I was going to moderate a little Q&A afterward, which I was totally stoked about.
Coolest person we've had do it. It was like, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden, as the board started getting more and more delayed.
Then you guys were stuck in Houston?
Houston, yeah.
Oh, that's a bummer.
The planet Houston.
I thought about it. I was like, should I ask if they want me to come down there and just do a little chat with the audience?
I mean, we were literally trying to think of things to do, and we were like, what if he FaceTimed? And I was like, I don't think it's going to be fun for him or me or them.
I would have done it, man.
I would have done it, too, but then Julie made a point. She's like, we wouldn't have been. Yeah, everyone would have went. Everybody would have. Yeah, what? Who does this? No. So, yeah.
But, yeah, The Oath in the fine tradition of holiday films.
It's like White Christmas, but for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to set it up, but I figure you probably have a more accurate and succinct recap without giving away, I don't want to give it away.
If you can imagine, if I can transport you to a country where it's politically divided and there's a president who is obsessed with loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's like this fictional president has asked the citizenry to sign this loyalty oath.
Yeah.
And it really has divided the country even more. And people are like, how could you? I'm not signing. Screw you. I am signing.
Which you don't have to sign, but you get a tax credit.
Exactly. It's not compulsory, but it's very highly suggested.
Yeah.
And kind of the deadline to sign this is the Friday after Thanksgiving, Black Friday. And the whole movie more or less takes place that week of Thanksgiving. And the character I play, a guy named Chris, is a little bit like I was a few years ago, like completely consumed by the 24-hour news cycle and the changes in government and stuff, and is making everyone crazy. And so kind of the first part of the movie is kind of this, family comedy about not talking about politics in the holidays.
Right,
and
for
then,
sure.
Yeah. And then it takes this turn where we kind of have these government forces kind of show up at the house.
Yeah,
and then
it definitely goes dark.
It goes dark. We go dark. Yeah. I think it's fun.
Yeah.
I think I tell people someone said to me I'll just I'm not going to go. I'm going to see it when it comes out on iTunes. And I was like, no. Here's why you got to see this movie in the theaters, because there's two kinds of movies I like to see in a theater.
Uh-huh.
Comedies and tense thrillers, right? Because you feed off the energy and we get a little bit of that. So I tell people, no, this is when you go see the movie.
Well, I think I did want to ask you, first of all, I think you delivered laughs when it was desperately needed as a viewer, as an audience member, which was great. It was it really, the word comic relief is...
It's truly is relieving.
So truly relieving in this case, because it gets, genuinely tense.
Yeah, it's heavy duty.
But tonally, it's such a tough thing to pull off a tonal switch like that, and I think you nailed it.
Oh, thanks.
So I'm curious, when you were writing the script and conceiving of it, I'm sure you wrestled with that a lot.
I did. There are a couple movies that I think, have kind of gone there a little bit in terms of – there's a great movie called Mrs. Miniver. Old movie, William Wyler movie from 1947. And kind of the first third of that movie is this kind of pleasant life in this pastoral English village.
Mm-hmm.
And the backdrop is World War II, but everyone's still kind of happy. And then the kind of the second part of the movie is the Nazis in the house.
Right.
And I saw that movie when I was young. And then also, too, in the last few years, we've seen movies that do kind of have like I loved Get Out. And I thought Get Out did this great thing where they take you to the edge of your seat, and then all of a sudden his friend who works for TSA, Lil Rel's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
The movie Philomena. Mm-hmm. You remember that movie with Steve Coogan and Dame Judi Dench? That movie is like the most serious subject matter ever. It's like the Catholic Church killing kids or something. Yeah. It's crazy. But at the core of it is this kind of like odd couple comedy about this like posh man and this poor old lady. So I knew that like I knew in my head there were examples that worked and you could kind of move back and forth. And you know, it's one thing to write it and it's one thing to shoot it, but for a movie like this, in terms of executing a tone, you really can't tell until you see some kind of assembly.
Yeah, it's got to be a little nerve-wracking.
It was. Because if that doesn't work, the movie does not work. And there's really no reshoots that could save it or anything. So you were
kind of all in on it.
We're all in, exactly. So we kind of breathed a sigh of relief when our great editor, Jack Price, showed us the assembly, and we knew that it made sense. Mm-hmm. It had work to do. We had a lot of, you know, stuff to do on it, but we knew that structurally and tonally, it was going to work.
Right.
So that was a huge sigh of relief.
Yeah. Great cast. Amazing cast. Tiffany Haddish, which, you know, she's so busy. Like, I imagine just scheduling her was difficult. Yeah,
it was. I mean, I saw her a long time ago in this movie called Keanu with Key and Peele.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She was at the cat, exactly. A little forte. It's like a pimp or something. I was really taken by her. I was just like, gosh, she's so, like, tough and, like, authentic. She'd be a good wife for me in a movie one day.
Yeah.
And so I right when I kind of started conceiving the movie, The Oath, and I knew that the core of it was going to be this kind of husband and wife, I was like, oh, it's got to be Tiffany Haddish. And we have the same manager, and I was like, hey, I really would love her. And she hadn't. Girls Trip hadn't even come out yet.
Oh, okay.
So
that's great.
You know, and then when I got her the script and she read it, and we met just after Girls Trip had come out. So she was starting to get big. But then, you know, months, I kept being nervous that she was just going to, like, you know, we were going to get the call, hey, she's the main hero in the new Star Wars movie. She's out.
Right.
You know, but that call, you know, she, God bless her. She made a commitment. She showed up every day.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome. And like, scheduling was insane because, like, I there's been a few times in my life where I've seen someone go from like famous to really famous, but never like her, where like she would literally like shoot 2 days, go fly, host SNL, come back, shoot for 3 days, go to Vegas, do stand up, come up. Like she's just so busy, but she, you know, she showed up and just delivered, man.
That's awesome.
And it's a different part for her because, you know, as you know, the first kind of, you know, her character Kai, the first you know, half of the movie or so, she's just stressed and she's internalizing all these feelings, and her husband is making her crazy with his constant, you know, news theories and stories and stuff, and she's really like internalizing everything. And then when she finally does pop and explode, she really kind of, you know, just stays there, and it was really fun to watch her. She's like a shark, you know, she has to move to stay alive.
Yeah.
And to watch her play that contained kind of like, it was really fun to watch. Yeah,
and it's I mean, it's obviously a social statement on what's going on in our country now.
Yeah.
But I also felt like, I mean, me as like a liberal hippie in the South, also a statement on being obsessed as a liberal with what's going on to like an unhealthy degree.
100%. You know,
I see it happening.
Yeah.
All around me.
It's less, the movie really is, honestly, and I'm not just saying this, it's not like really about politics. It's about this family and their reactions to it.
Absolutely.
And how this, you know, current government and the new cycle that accompanies it have been just right and left breaking people's brains.
Mm-hmm.
And how otherwise smart, normal people are losing it, and they're obsessed, and they're, and I know it's coming from a place of like terror, and they're scared and stuff,
right?
But people on, and I hate to use the term both sides because I'm not a both sides-er. Firmly am on one side, which I believe is fundamentally good.
Yeah, yeah.
But we are still seeing. You still do see, like, I know smart people that follow insane liberal conspiracy theorists on Twitter and stuff, and they promote it and stuff. It's not as bad.
Right.
You know, I will never say that, but just watching people just let it completely consume their lives. I know now that it's not healthy. I went through that.
Yeah.
And, you know, one morning I was with my wife. This is maybe, you know, 3 months after Trump won, and it's like 6:22 a.m. And she's breastfeeding our child. And I'm reading some god-awful article or something, and I turn to her and I just go, like, almost with like a tear in my eye, and I'm like, America's lost.
Yeah.
And she goes, hey, dude, too heavy. 6:22 a.m. I got a kid on my boob.
Yeah.
I don't need like the yeah. Sturm und Drang and the, you know, the word, uh-huh. it's all over. So I think like, you know, the best way to kind of to do that news intake is to really, you got to really manage it carefully.
Yeah.
You know, you like almost like coffee, you know, you have right. to take a little bit when you wake up, have a cup at noon. Maybe a cup of, you know, decaf at night.
Yeah.
But, and at the same token, I know people who are handling all this by completely unplugging, and I think that's bad too.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a middle ground where you can do the right thing as a citizen and be involved and active, but you have to take care of yourself too.
You need mental health, man.
Yeah.
We got to watch out for ourselves.
For sure.
And, you know, it is finding that balance. And I think I'm starting to now kind of get the balance. And you know what I mean? I think I am, although I literally just tweeted something to the president on the way over here. But he was talking about like POWs are the greatest. And yeah. I was like, hey man, the ghost of John McCain is going to take a dump in your mouth tonight while you're sleeping. So I still do that. Ghost poop.
That's the worst.
Wasn't that a Bill Cosby movie?
I think so.
That's Ghost Dad. I'm trying to find that balance still. I'm much closer than I was 2 years ago, but yeah. it is something that I'm trying to do. And I know a lot of people are too.
Yeah. By the time you have it all worked out, then hopefully he'll be gone.
Hopefully then Don Jr. will be president.
Jesus.
When I make that joke, you just watch people's smiles just disappear. They're like, I don't even like that. Not even as a joke.
Not even funny. And then your brother is in this movie and is hysterical.
Yeah.
And I have a brother. And part of me when I was watching this was like, I sense a little bit of brotherly, like, you're kind of fucking with him a little bit just to make him play this guy.
100%.
In real life.
Yeah, my brother in real life is more liberal than me, man. Like,
painful was that for him?
It was tough. I mean, the whole movie actually, the impetus came from after the election, that Thanksgiving, right?
We're
at my after dinner, me and my mom and my brother getting this huge fight about Trump.
Uh-huh.
And it is your fault. And the crazy thing is we all like enthusiastically voted for Hillary Clinton.
Right.
My brother was a little bit more of a Bernie guy.
Yeah, yeah.
My mom was kind of, you know, she's based in Ohio and her whole thing was like, they forgot about Ohio, forgot about Ohio.
Right.
So, you know, politically we're all aligned, but my brother, you know, when I knew that this kind of main antagonist to me was going to be my brother, I was like, okay, I got to cast my real brother. I know he's a great actor,
yeah.
right? Like he's got the comedy chops, but I also like remember, and again, this is, you only get this with a brother where I saw him at the Steppenwolf Training Center do a Sam Shepard play and he was brilliant.
Yeah,
and I was
yeah.
like, okay, so I know he'll be funny.
Uh-huh.
I know he can deliver emotionally, but more importantly, I got 35 years of history.
Yeah.
I threw a bag of change in his head one time, and he cried a lot.
Yeah.
So I knew that especially in those scenes at like the Thanksgiving dinner table, I could get him to a place where he is legitimately mad,
right.
and vice versa. You know what I mean? Like, there's a couple moments where maybe he wasn't paying attention,
uh-huh.
and I was kind of like, "Hey, man, come on, we don't have time." And like, I'm mad, and he's mad, and my mom, when she saw the movie, she goes, "I know there are scenes where you were being mean to Jonathan." I was like, yeah, but I paid him. Chill out.
Oh, that's great, though. That's cool, too, to work with family
it
like
was
that.
So, it was so great. My dad's actually in it, too. He's the voice of my attorney.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And you would have thought that, you know, we brought back Ian McKellen
know,
to do it. He was like, do you want me to do it again? Do you want me to send it out? I can do another version. Do you want me to do a voice? And I was like, no, you're good, though.
Man, that was so tense. Like, even that just triggered me when you were trying to get in touch with your attorney on the phone. And it's a comedy, and I'm just like, fucking answer, please.
I know. It's stressful.
It goes there, you know?
It is stressful. I just think we're living in stressful and absurd times, right?
Well, those you captured
like,
that.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I wanted. I want to make fun of it and like, make people feel, like, a little uncomfortable and itchy. Yeah,
you did.
You did.
So, speaking of family, I always like to talk to people about their sort of pop culture life growing up.
Yes.
In Chicago, was that a big part of your life? Do you have any other siblings? Movie night a thing?
It was just my brother and I, and my dad was, both my parents were theater majors, right?
Okay.
My mom was more of a costume designer, and my dad was an actor.
Uh-huh.
And so the arts were huge for us.
Yeah.
Like dinner conversation was a lot of times about like movies and television shows and books and stuff. And God bless my parents. I mean, I know it was the 80s and it was a different time, but my parents, like, let us watch it.
Right.
Like, we could watch Trading Places, and we could watch Beverly Hills Cop, and we could watch Vacation, and we could watch The Godfather.
Yeah.
So they really didn't baby us, and they really, you know, sometimes, I mean, I'll never forget when my brother was, like, three or four, they let him watch The Last Boy Scout. And I was like, what are you doing? Even a kid, I was like, that's bad parenting. But they really did. They nurtured it. And they really, I think, are responsible more than anyone for my both me and my brother having a relatively high pop culture IQ.
Yeah. Now, were you both acting at an early age?
No, not at all. I wanted to be a politician.
Really?
Yeah. My dad was also kind of friends with some local, in Chicago, their alderman.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so he was kind of friendly with some of those guys. I'm sure they're all in jail now. but I loved Election Day, and I would go with him to the polling places.
Really? As a kid, you were into that?
I was, only for two reasons. One, they just had good food. Like, you could get good donuts and milk duds and popcorn. But I did love not just the glamour of it, and the swagger of these ridiculous characters. I remember there was one guy named Zenkich, and I don't even know what the hell he was running for. He was this big, Romanian or Polish immigrant, big guy, big, giant, slick back hair. Uh-huh. And he had all these combs that said Zenkich on it. And he gave me one, and he goes, every time you comb your hair, you will think of Zenkich. And I kind of do now. But the kind of cheesy aspect of it that really resonated with me was like watching these candidates talk to their, constituents or possible constituents, and this kind of combination of a constituent looking up to a politician and really needing help, well, whatever level, it's fixing a pothole or newer housing or something, and having these politicians look at them and say, I'm going to take care of you. Like, there was something about that I really just, the nurturing of it, I thought was really, really cool. So in my mind, I was also the kid that like would like be like, well, let's watch Ronald Reagan's 1984 convention speech.
Right.
And then when Clinton was up, I was like, well, let's just check this guy out.
Right.
So I was very interested in it. And then, as that kind of started to subside and I went to college and discovered pot and all that stuff, I was like,
oh, well,
I can never be president, but now I can.
Sure, you can do anything now.
Anyone can be president. That's the good news. Despite that, I would say that even though we didn't act or perform other than like a school play here and there, arts and entertainment was really, and pop culture was really the basis of our family's house. And the third kind of component growing up in Chicago in the late 80s and 90s was, of course, basketball.
Right.
Because we had Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. And it was just like, I think I watched every Chicago Bulls game from like 88 to 95.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
I mean, I love the Bulls, and I was a Hawks fan.
I mean, that's
just one of those things.
That was a great, Hawks team, too. Spud Webb and Dominique.
Yeah. No, we had some decent teams back then.
I can tell you this. I went to the 1988 Slam Dunk Contest in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to tell you, as someone who was there, I will be honest, Neek should have won that one. Dominique Wilkins won that dunk. It was a home. Because he got like a basically like an aggregate of like a 4.9, and Jordan got like a 5 or like a 4.95, and it was like, no, Neek had that.
Which year was that for Jordan, though? Was that the...
That was not the flight symbol.
Okay.
That was the year after.
Gotcha.
Yeah, he should have won for the flight symbol.
Yeah.
But the year after, I think Dominique had his number, and it was a little bit of a homerism.
I haven't watched that in years. I used to be really into that stuff.
It was
better back then, right?
It was better back then. It was also just dunks were still new.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's like there's not much they can do now.
Yeah, I still love basketball.
Yeah,
like, I love it. But that All-Star Weekend, I don't really – because also the All-Star Weekend itself is just kind of like, doesn't really matter. And it's just no one wants to get hurt, and they're just like, shooting half-court shots.
Seems
and stuff.
Like it used to be a bigger deal.
It was a bigger deal. It was
and
just
Bird
new.
In the three-point contest. It was just
Craig
like,
Hodges. Remember
so
Craig
great.
Hodges?
Oh, yeah.
He won 3 years in a row.
Yeah, that's right.
He was amazing, too.
Man, those 80s years, that was some good basketball.
Between Bird and Johnson and Young Barkley. Remember Young Barkley in the 76?
Oh, yeah.
He was just devastating.
Yeah. He would throw his ass and like three guys would go flying. Yeah, Olajuwon.
You know you missed that. If you're on a team with Rick Mahorn and you have the biggest ass, that's a lot.
Oh, Mahorn. Man, I forgot about him. Those were good years. Yeah, and back when, the Knicks were fun to watch back then,
they
too.
They were great. Yeah. You had Ewing and Gerald Wilkins and
John Anthony. Starks.
I heard a great story. I don't know if it's true or not. It's not even my story, but someone told me that they saw John Starks somewhere at Madison Square Garden, and this guy went up to him and was like a huge Knicks fan. He's like, John, man, I am like the biggest fan. Starks just looked at him and he's like, can I get your autograph? And Starks like, yeah, sure. And he says, my name is, it's Mark with a C. And Starks looks at him and is like, and he wrote C-A-R-K. He said Mark with a C, and he was like, oh, Kark?
Are you serious?
That's what I heard.
Oh, my God.
I heard that story.
That story's too, like, weird to
it's
be
too,
made
it's
up.
Too, yeah, it's too specific. God, John Starks, he was so good, man.
Yeah.
Oh, he used to shut Jordan down. It drove me crazy.
Well, he was just money when it counted. You know, he's not like an all time great, but
no, just like a, not like a generational player, but just like a decade player. Like you could watch that guy play for a decade.
Absolutely. Yeah. You still Bulls fan, I guess.
Yeah. Or? You know, it's kind of depressing when I think about that now that LeBron's gone and we could have kept Jimmy Butler and been relatively competitive in the East. Mm-hmm. But I still do try to watch, you know, maybe a dozen Bulls games a year if I can.
Yeah.
I'm excited. We have, I'm also like, I'm excited to live in LA when LeBron's there. Like, I love LeBron James. Like, I think he is a great guy. Uh-huh. I love watching him play.
Yep.
And I'm excited for him to be in L.A.
Yeah, and he's a guy that, like, he gets shit, and he's a dude that has spent his entire life doing it right, except for, like, the one, you know, the decision thing that was, he has since said, wow, I didn't do that right.
I think you should be very skeptical of people who hate LeBron James.
For sure.
I don't understand that.
I know.
There's like a weird thing there where I just don't get it.
Yeah.
Also, you had the best. Didn't you call Trump a chump?
Oh, I mean, he's.
Oh, no, I called him a bum.
Yeah.
And I remember reading that and being like, that's such a good old bum. It's really good. It sticks with you.
Well, when did you get into acting then?
You know, I went to, I gave college a try, and we didn't get along. I went to Boston University, but I didn't go to, like, to get into the main program, I had to do, like, a one-year thing there that's basically for, like, hockey players.
Right.
Or, like, kids like me who were, like, had pretty decent test scores, but, like, bad grades because they didn't like to work right. So I got there, and right away, it wasn't working out, you know, and it was a bit of a you're fired, I quit situation. Mm. And I had come back to Chicago, and I knew that, like, acting made sense. And I was, like, I kind of, you know, locked myself in my dorm room for a few weeks and watched a bunch of movies over and over and over again. And my dad was friends with the woman whose brother was at Improv Olympic and was a performer. He took me to see their 15th anniversary show in Chicago at the Vic Theater. And it was, like, definitely a seminal moment in my life because I saw – Amy Poehler and Adam McKay, and specifically Tim Meadows.
Yeah.
You know, Tim Meadows. Tim Meadows did this bit that night. I'll never forget it. He did like this long bit about, at the time, there was this movie that came out that weekend called Solo, starring Mario Van Peebles. Uh-huh. Weird movie. No one ever saw it. But he kept referring to it, and people weren't even laughing, but I was laughing so hard, and I was like, oh, I think I can do this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think I could try. So I started taking, you know, improv classes there at Second City at the Great Annoyance Theater, and I really just kind of gave myself to the world.
Yeah.
I worked at Second City at night as a busboy. I took every class you could. I went to every single show you could until I was able to start kind of performing, and then you start performing, and you're really bad, and then you get a little bit better and better, and then I just kind of started clicking a little bit more, and I went through Chicago in about 3.5 years.
Uh-huh.
And then
all improv, any stand up or just?
No, I never really got into the stand up. I've done it like 4 times
yeah.
and it's gone well, and I don't want to ever have a bad stand up set. So I'm just going to walk away.
Retire batting a thousand.
Exactly. Like Ty Williams. And but I never got into the stand up. I loved the kind of fusion of acting and writing that you get from long form improvisation. And you know, there's two kinds of improv. There's like Whose Line Is It Anyways, which is like short form and game based. And then there's the Chicago style, the Herald as they call it, which is much more kind of based in characters and scenes.
Yeah.
And that to me was just so exciting that you could go up and on stage and play 5 different characters or do 5 different scenes. You could play the president, you could play, you know, a ninja, you could play everything. So I loved it. And I started kind of getting the hang of it more. And then I made this move out to Amsterdam.
Oh, wow.
There's a theater there called Boom Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it was founded by like 3 Northwestern alums who were backpacking and stuff. And
Amsterdam, Holland.
Okay.
Yeah. I was just making sure.
Not
wasn't
New
Amsterdam,
Connecticut.
Illinois. Or
no. Amsterdam, Holland. These guys opened this theater. And at first, it was just like 3 schmucks in the back of a bar.
Uh-huh.
By the time I got there, it was like a proper dinner theater with, you know, a few hundred seats. And, you know, the prime minister would come and you would get up. And I got there. I replaced Seth Meyers.
Oh, wow.
He was the cast member. And I went there. And I was there for about 2 years. And we had a great group. We had a... Jason Sudeikis, Jordan Peele.
You guys are all living in Amsterdam.
We were all living in Amsterdam.
That must have been crazy. And
it was so great because it was the it was like 99, 2000. Yeah. It was like the Gilder was still going on, so it was like 2-1.
So
it was, everything was a half off.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just a simpler time. Like I got into house music and would go out and dance.
Right.
It was great. And
it looked fun.
Yeah, it was fun. And then, you know, from there, I have my partner, my longtime writing partner from Chicago, Dave Stassen, and we had plans. We were like, we'll move to L.A. We wrote for the high school newspaper. We can just write movies or something.
Right.
And so the two of us, and because it's the same thing, yeah. You know, and the two of us and Seth Myers and his brother Josh and another friend, we all kind of moved out to L.A. in early 2000, and, you know, we're like, okay, this is our life now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was your brother tagging along at this point, or?
No, he's significantly younger than me. He's like 6-7 years younger than me.
Okay.
So he was, you know, still in college. He was like in high school, I think, actually, at that time. But once he kind of went through college and he moved back to Chicago and did a few years in Chicago doing the improv circuit, he told me, it's like, I want to come to L.A.
And
he did.
And you got work pretty quickly in L.A.?
Not as quick as I would have liked.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had like a, you know, about, 20 really bad months where I was like, I mean, I couldn't even get a job. Wait, like everyone's like, you're a waiter in LA. I couldn't even like be a busser. They wouldn't even hire me as a busser. And as far as like the acting is concerned, I had one audition in those 20 months to be an onion in a Quiznos commercial.
Oh man.
Yeah. And I've
heard some hard luck stories. That was pretty.
When you are like, I'm not a very religious person, but I remember praying that I get to be an onion. May I be an onion. And so, yeah, I was kind of in that, like, you know, struggling, hungry, salad day, whole L.A. thing. And it wasn't until I wrote a 2-man sketch show with Seth's brother, Josh Myers, and we put it up at I.O. And our friend was Nicole Sullivan, right, who was on Mad TV,
great actor.
And she came and saw it, and she's like, I'm going to tell the Mad TV producers to come check you out. And they came. And Will Sasso and Alex Borstein, who just won an Emmy
the other night,
amazing.
They were
together.
So cool.
So cool.
Yeah.
They had just left, and they needed replacements, and they hired us. And that was really my first, like, legit showbiz gig.
Yeah, and you were on Mad TV off and on for a while,
straight through 5 years.
Yeah.
I was there, and I was always like, felt like I was probably going to get fired just because I wasn't very good on that. Like, that show, Mad TV, is so all about like those big stock characters, right? Like Stewart or Miss Swan.
Yeah.
And I'm not good at that. Like, I'm just not. And so I would always play like, you know, the straight man, always.
Right.
And my whole thing was always like, James Brown, get out of my car lot. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? John Madden, what are you doing at my pancake house where I'm the manager? And
it's fun for a while, though.
It's fun for a while. And it really was. For the first like year or two, I was like, this is great. I'm making money and I got to come and do a show and meet people. And then I started, I don't want to say feeling myself. I just got restless.
Yeah.
I would get restless, not just with, the show, but also just, you know, why aren't you doing this?
Yeah.
You know, I was a dick.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I was just like, why aren't we doing this? We should be doing this and not this. And eventually, I think Mad TV was like, they knew the end was near for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, you can go. We're releasing you. You can go. Which I thought once Mad TV ended, you know, I would go to a sitcom. And that's the transition.
Uh-huh.
And like, after I was fired from Mad TV for all intents and purposes, began like a very dark, like 2.5. I don't want to say very dark, like I was like shooting up smack.
Right.
But like, I really had a hard time getting hired for anything.
Yeah.
And it was tough too, because at that point I had already met my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and we were living together. And
right.
It's kind of one of those things too, where I met her and I was like, come live with me in LA. I'm on a TV show. And she dropped her life, came to LA. And then like a month later, it's like, I'm out of work.
Yeah.
Which is tough. You have to like, really like, you know, it's tough.
Yeah.
And yeah, no one would hire me. I would get like small parts and like, you know, like, remember all those spoof movies they made in the middle 2000s? Uh-huh. I would do like parts in that, which was, I was so thankful that they would like pay me money and I would get to go to New Orleans and shoot for a week or so. So that really kept me going. But it was at that point I really said to myself, I need to really commit to my writing because I don't think it's going to work as an actor.
And make your own future.
That's it. And even if I just end up being like writing copy at an ad firm, great.
Right.
But like, the acting thing is just not going to happen. I just have a crazy, weird face, and I have a giant space in my teeth, and it's not going to work. So my partner moved back. He was living in D.C., working for ESPN, and he came back, and we were like, let's write something.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote, and wrote like maybe one or two scripts that didn't quite make it, but then we wrote one that we sold. We sold it.
Yeah.
And we were like, we're writers now.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, it's the greatest day. And then we were like, okay, well, they're going to make the movie and that'll be any minute now. And then we'll be like, we'll have a movie in the, you know, in the can under our belt. And the movie we sold in 2008 did not get made until 2016.
Wow.
Or 2015.
What movie was it?
Central Intelligence, starring Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart.
Nice.
Yeah, it was, I mean, we wrote it back in 2009, and in our mind, it was like Ed Helms and Danny McBride.
Right.
And it just shows you like 7 years later, two totally different guys are playing it. But that really did, that was another kind of big moment selling that script, because once you sell a script, then you start to be seen as a writer, and you can go and meet other producers and, and directors and stuff. So we really were living in that writing space, and that's how we made our money. We would sell one script a year and maybe do punch-ups on stuff and make a little bit extra money. But I was like, I'm just a writer now.
Right.
And
which is great. A
amazing.
Great career.
Loved it. Yeah. We were excited. There was still like an itch because I knew friends of mine were actors, and they were getting parts. And I was like, shit. And then one day I got a call to audition for Eastbound and Down, which I was a huge fan of that show.
Yeah, me too.
I love that show.
And I heard a little bit of Ivan earlier when you were...
a little. You can hear it a little bit.
Yeah,
little
man. It's so good.
Ivan right now, I feel like, definitely helped get Donald Trump elected. He was at that meeting. I was at Trump Tower. I was there. I was the number... I was the question mark. But that was the first time a show that I was a like crazy fan of.
Yeah.
I could have maybe worked for. And they call me into audition to be the catcher, to be the catcher, right? And I was literally driving to the audition, and I got the call. They were like, hey, they put an offer out to someone. And I was like, oh. And I was like, is there anything else? And they're like, well, there's this pitcher, but he's Russian. And I was like, I can do a Russian accent. So I went and I read, and then Danny, I met with him and Jody Hill the next day, and it was the improv training that got me the job.
Because that's great.
I came in and read it, but then, you know, reading with Danny, and Danny's one of the best improvisers in the planet. And right away, he was like, what's your fucking problem, dude? What's your problem, man? I'm being a dick, Ivan. I was like, I'm being a dick. You are biggest dick ever. Your dick is big, and you are it. And he just started, like, dying in the room. He's like, all right, fucking, let's do it.
He's like, are you willing to get the worst haircut on TV?
Well, he snuck that on me after I landed there. I was in, literally sitting in there for my camera test, and he comes in, and he's like, my man, let me show you a picture right now. And I want you to know you do not have to do this, but I just want to show you a picture. And you make the decision. And he showed me like a Czechoslovakian sophomore in high school's haircut in like 1988. He's like, what do you think? And I was like, shit, man, let's do it.
Yeah.
And that part wasn't bad. The rough part was coming back 8 months later to do reshoots and having to get the haircut again a week before one of my best friend's wedding.
So I was
at that wedding, and no one had seen the show yet. I just looked like a mental patient. People were like, what are you doing?
Well, and the bride's like, thanks, stealing my thunder. What a dick.
Wow, you've managed to take the focus and be an asshole. So, but that show, again, that was the other kind of one of the big moments for me where I'll never forget they had a premiere screening for it, and it was the first time where people that I looked up to came up to me, like Will Forte and Adam Scott came up to me, and they were like, dude, that was great. And I was like, oh my God, that's great. And because of that part, Mindy Kaling was a fan of that show, and she started tweeting at me, and she was like, you're very, very funny and stuff. So it was right around that time where she kind of just, you know, discovered me and was like, you know, I met with her to write on her show, and from Eastbound and Down for sure got me the part on the Mindy project.
That's great.
Yeah, it was great.
Very cool, man.
So thankful to those people.
Well, let's talk about Goodfellas.
Mm-hmm. The best movie ever?
Well, I will say this, too. You initially picked The Godfather, and I was like, great. Godfather, perfect.
Great.
And then you changed your mind, and they asked if that was okay and too late. And I was just like, I'm just glad he's like actually giving this thought, like that meant something to me, that you were like, well, no, let me change Godfather to Goodfellas.
Here's the thing. Godfather, I saw first.
Yeah.
It's a perfect movie. There's like 30 perfect movies.
Sure. Ever.
That's one of them. And then I saw Goodfellas, and I've gotten in big fights with friends of mine over what is better. And I think the only way you can look at it is like, one of them is like Beethoven's Greatest Symphony.
Yeah.
And the other one is like the Rolling Stones' best album.
Yeah.
Like what's better, you know what I mean?
Like what's better?
What mood are you in? Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but at the end of the day, Goodfellas is the movie that I remember seeing it opening night at the Esquire Theater in Chicago, and in my mind being like, "This is I've never seen anything like yeah. this." It changed my life.
Yeah, Scorsese. Like, I mean, I've seen it. Jeez, so many times. And then I always rewatch though for this, so I can take notes and really like give it that study, and which is great because new things always jump out at me sure. when you look at it through like a sort of a school-like lens.
And then you start to see new faces. Like, yeah. Yeah, last time I watched, I was like, oh, shit, Paulie Walnuts from The Sopranos is one of the yeah. guys in Tootie's Kitchen.
That's right. Yeah. I don't think you even noticed that last night.
Yeah.
But something that really jumped out at me was just how, like, punk rock it was for a major studio film. Like, it had all the energy and sort of like, Mean Streets.
Yeah.
But it was... Like, Scorsese was well established at this point, yeah. and he still kind of made this movie true to his roots with, like, fast camera moves and short scenes and breaking the fourth wall and freeze frames.
Ultra-violence.
Jumping around in time. And, like, yeah. he just fucking threw everything
yeah.
in the kitchen sink in there.
Yeah.
Which was just ballsy.
He also, I remember even being young and thinking, like, holy shit, halfway through the movie, the fucking narrator changes. It becomes his wife.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, like, it's so genius. You know what I mean? Like, in all these mob movies, they're always just so male-dominated. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? And to take his wife, who's not just, like, I'm the disapproving wife, but, like,
right.
she's all coked out and into yeah. it, too. And it is a... perfect movie.
Yeah, well, and she has that great bit of narration there. I don't know if that was the switch, but when he beats the shit out of her across the street neighbor.
I don't know.
In one of the best scenes. But
ever.
She was like, I know a lot of women that would have, but she's, but.
It turned me on.
It turned me on.
It's like, it's so true, too.
I know. It's so honest.
Oh, yeah. I can like still, I like have the rhythm of his feet crossing the street
oh, yeah.
to go. Pistol whip that kid. Like,
yeah,
I still
yeah.
have the cadence of his footsteps.
Well, and that guy is so dumb to front him. Like, you know, you want a piece or whatever he said?
Yeah, what are you fucking looking at? Or something like
dude,
that. And his friend goes, don't shoot.
No idea.
You have no
the
idea.
The world of hurt. Yeah. And the way he pistol whips him, everything is so specific and badass. Like, not that I want to promote violence, but if you're going to do it in a movie, like, this is the way to do
That's
it.
That's the way to do it. It is. Also, and the great thing about it, too, is that Scorsese follows the most important rule of doing a mob movie, which Coppola didn't necessarily do, which is the first part is glamorous.
Yeah.
But then it shows you what animals they are
yeah.
and how brutal and petty and they just don't care about you and how your life will end up terrible. The best way it could end
yeah.
is you end up in Arizona eating egg noodles with ketchup.
Yeah.
That's the best way it's going to end. So I love that there is kind of this lesson at the end of the day, which is like, don't go in the mafia.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, Pecci, there's something about unhinged like characters that make me so nervous when I watch a movie.
Yep.
It's such an effective thing to do. And you actually did that, now that I think about it, with Yoth, with the Mason character.
Yeah.
Like,
what's he going to do?
Yeah, like a character that you don't know what the yep. fuck they're going to do next, and they're dangerous.
They're stressing you out.
It's so yeah. stressful to
yeah.
watch. And
yeah.
they established this with Pecci so early on of like, you know, the second that, what was his name? The,
Billy Batts.
Billy Batts says, get your shine box.
Go get your fucking, you motherfucking, you
like,
piece
it's
of
over.
Shit.
Like, it's over. His death sentence
it's
right there.
It's over. And you know he's going to die, and it's ultimately what kills Joe
yeah,
Pesci.
Absolutely.
And he just doesn't care. He's just, he's an egg timer. He's ready
yeah.
to go. And he is, yeah, man, he's amazing. But also, like, great tertiary characters like Frankie Carbone.
Oh, yeah.
I thought you said you want the coffee to go. I was kidding. Like, that is really good. You know who we love? The guy goes, it's under my mother's name.
You're right.
That mode when De Niro's, like, angry about the money being spent is, like, it's so funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
He goes, there's so much humor in the
movie. Take the jacket off. Take the jacket off right
yeah.
now. It's so good, man. It's so good. Yeah, it's amazing.
And Maury, like, what a great character.
What am I, a schmuck on wheels? Fuck him. And Ray Liotta goes, okay, you want to go tell him? Go tell him to shut up.
Yeah. Well, Ray Liotta, I mean, he's the peacemaker through 99% of this movie.
And he's a psychopath.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is. He still is.
Yeah, yeah.
God, he's beautiful in that movie.
He's so
like,
great.
He is. The first two things I ever saw him in were Something Wild and that.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, this is the greatest. Like, I mean, his eyes are so mournful and just broken. He's a broken guy.
Yeah, he looks like he's wearing eyeliner.
Yeah.
But that's just like
that's
Ray
just
Liotta.
That's Ray Liotta. That's just the beauty of Liotta.
His his Marc Maron interview is really good. I don't know if you've heard that one.
I have not heard that one.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah, he's had a tough break, you know, the last few years. It's been hard, you know, I think, for him. But I think, you know, he has a body of work he could look back on.
Sure.
Yeah, you know what he's great into is Copland.
Oh, yeah,
it's
yeah.
Great. The movie's
they
good.
About that.
You blew
movie.
It.
Well, and he's such a menacing presence on screen and can play such an asshole. And it's like not like that in real life. And even
he seems like a nice guy.
He is a nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think people sort of want him a little bit to be
Henry.
Yeah.
Just scary guy.
Henry's a likable character in a lot of ways.
Very likable. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So is Jimmy. I think. God, even Pesci is.
They're so charming.
Yeah.
Like they really are. Robert De Niro in that movie, man. There is a scene when he makes the decision that he's going to kill Morty.
Yep.
And they start playing "Sunshine of Your Love."
Yeah.
Where it's like,
oh man, the
never
music cues are ridiculous.
Never before has a man looked cooler on.
Yeah.
He's smoking that cigarette, and you see him figuring out in his head, and they start cream kicks in, and it's just like,
yeah. Oh,
it's
well,
so cool.
there are so many. The other thing that really hit me watching it yesterday for the gazillionth time was there are so many life and death decisions that are made just like that.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes, like, in that case, you see it on his face. You know that he's made his mind up. And then later on, when Pesci and Maury are joking around at the table, you see De Niro laughing, and you see it change, and he leans over, and he's like, remember what I was talking about? Just forget about that.
And I love the look on Leota's face, the relief.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, ah, you know what I mean?
No, because like, he didn't want to whack him.
If you're sitting at a table all night, and you know someone there is going to be murdered,
I know.
Like, it's so stressful.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the guy's like, yeah, fuck it. And you're like,
yeah.
Okay, all right, I'm going to get some food.
Yeah. But that doesn't last, because Maury starts breaking his balls again. And then gets the ice pick through the back of the neck.
Maury's a troublemaker, man.
Yeah.
He is. He's you know what he is? I'm Jewish. A guy like Maury, we call him a nudge.
A nudge?
He's a nudge. Just stop nudging me. The best thing, too, is the way he realizes he's going to kill him, he goes, do you think Maury tells his wife everything?
Yeah.
Like, if someone asked that question, like, they're clearly going to kill that person.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
poor
good.
Maury.
Poor Maury.
Henry boy.
Oh, Henry boy, the pipes are calling.
He was so good.
He's so good.
And the other thing, too, is everything is so, it's just so businesslike.
Mm-hmm.
Like, after they whack Sam Jackson.
Yeah.
And with the coffee
Make
and
the
joking.
Coffee. Yeah.
After they whack whack Maury with the ice pick through the head. Frank Carbone wants to warm up the engine to the Cadillac.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What are you doing, stuttering? Come on, yeah.
He's like, I want to warm up the engine. Like, it's just so brilliant to throw in all those things. And the food that's like, there's always food around.
I can tell you the food, specific food that they're eating at that table. But De Niro, when he goes, delicious, he's eating a potato frittata.
Now, is this with Scorsese's mom?
This is Scorsese's mom.
All right, this is when they go.
After they put Bats in the car.
Bats is in the trunk
dying.
He's
in the trunk dying.
And they decide
go
to have a full meal at like whatever
midnight.
And
he goes, oh, Ma, I forgot. I got to use this knife. I hit a deer. And the best line is he goes, I got to hack off the foot. He goes, the hoof. And she goes, oh, God. He goes, yeah, but Ma, it's a sin. You can't leave it there. The fact that like they're lying about what's happening. And then he's like justifying it. No, but it's a sin. It's like so many lies.
I know.
Yeah. Well, it shows you again, like, I've been reading a lot of this old, long-ago writer named Hannah Arendt, who really studied totalitarianism.
Yeah.
And she talks about this conversation that people have in their head. Should I do something bad?
Mm-hmm.
And some people don't even ask that question because they don't do bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have some people who do bad things, but they have this conversation with themselves, and sometimes the conversation persuades them to not do that.
Okay.
But then there's some people who don't have the conversation and then just do the bad thing.
Right.
And I think that movie is all about guys who are the latter, and then Henry's the guy in the middle who does have that conversation.
So he justifies things. The rest don't even have to.
The rest, they don't even think about it. Like, they're just like you said, like, it's not like Joe Pesci was like, oh, I don't want to kill Stacks right now.
Right.
But I have to.
Yeah.
Or it's just like, boom, let's make some coffee. Let's go. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like they remove that, any empathy or any thought to it.
Yeah. And I think when those guys die, it's sort of the same. They accept death. Like, I know it's just very brief, but Pesci has that slight realization. Fuck, man, this is it.
And Scorsese, like, again, like, as glamorous as the scene is when they're watching Frankie Valli with champagne, watching Pesci bleed out on a cold linoleum floor with blood pouring out of his head. It's like, what a terrible way to go. And they shoot in the face and stuff. And it just shows you.
And like, it's like a rental house or something.
Yeah, it's so weird. And it just shows you, like, Scorsese is really telling you, like, hey, the mafia is bad.
Yeah.
Like, lest you think it's cool. Like, this is what I'm... This is
no,
where
for
up.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, and the blood is very effective, his use of blood. And then... And light, like the red bath of light when they're burying Billy.
Yeah.
Or not Billy, but...
Well, the blood looks cartoony in the beginning when they're like, they shot me. And they're like, yeah, put towels on his hand. Like, the blood is like light red. And then by the end, it's just like dark, that dark cakey.
Yeah.
Like, you know, where the brain's in there. And it's just so upsetting.
Well, you did a very fine job with blood yourself in The Oath.
I have an amazing makeup artist effects lady.
Because I watched them
wild.
Both in the same day. And I was like,
oh, Jesus.
Man, this guy's clearly been like... influenced by the gangster genre because you did the violence well. And the one fucking funny line in the movie when I don't want to give away too much, but things go very dark and there's a lot of blood at one point for various reasons. And you say, it's black. Was it black before?
Did I do that to him or was it like that already? Okay.
Like the black blood.
Why
is
it blood?
So
yeah.
Gnarly
I'm obsessed with black blood. Yeah, yeah. We really had a lot of conversations about that. It's like you don't
so
want
gross.
That. If you have like blood that's like really bright red, it looks almost like something you would see on like MASH, the TV show.
Yep.
And you need that dark. That dark, almost black blood pouring.
Was it black before?
Was it black before? Did I do that? Oh, shit.
Oh, man. That was such a funny line.
Thanks,
and again,
man.
Just when it was sorely needed.
Yes.
I'm going to read a few names off a list, and
Beautiful.
You just tell me.
First thing that comes to my head?
No.
Oh.
Just whatever you want to say. Anthony Stabile. Frankie Carbone.
Anthony Stabile is Frankie Carbone. funny fact about him. He sued The Simpsons.
Who did?
The guy who played Frankie Carbone.
Oh, no. His name wasn't Anthony Stabile.
Oh, wasn't?
No. But that guy who played him sued The Simpsons?
So you know Fat Tony on
The
Simpsons? So Fat Tony has like two henchmen.
Uh-huh.
And one looks exactly like Frankie Carbone.
Yeah,
he looks like him. And that guy that played Carbone, if I'm not mistaken, don't hold me to this, he sued The Simpsons like 5 or 10 years ago for something like $500 million.
Really?
And I was just like imagining him, this funny actor living somewhere in Jersey,
right.
Talking to his ridiculous attorney. And the attorney's like, I don't know. I think this is a big one. He's like, how much? He's like, I don't know, $500 million? He's like, let's do it.
No, these are the guys when they're walking through. Anthony Stabile, Frankie Carbone, Fat Andy. Frankie the Wop.
Frankie the Wop. He's the one who goes, how's it going, guy?
Freddie No-Nos.
Freddie No-Nos, yes.
Pete the Killer, who's Sally Ball's his brother.
Yeah.
Can you imagine writing these names, how much fun that was?
Pete the Killer, who's Sally Ball's brother.
Nicky Eyes,
he's got the big glasses.
Uh-huh. Mikey Francesi. And then, of course.
I talked to you guy about that thing.
Of course, Jimmy Two Times.
Yeah, Jimmy Two Times. I remember there was a Mr. Show sketch where there was a parody of Goodfellas called, like, Pally's or something. And they go, they called him Frankie One Times because he only said things one time. And he goes, it stinks. And they go, what'd you say? And he just looks at him. He only says things one time.
He won't repeat anything. And then we have to talk about the tracking shot, the Copacabana tracking shot.
Yes.
You are a director now.
Yes.
Can you imagine a more difficult scene to block in light?
Oh, no way, man.
Like, how did they do this?
Well,
it's a miracle.
It's a miracle. I have my homage to Goodfellas. I have this one long tracking shot in the movie that's kind of Thanksgiving Day, like the prep scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When you're walking through?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think every long tracking shot in a movie now is inspired by that.
Yeah, sure.
It's one of the most famous shots in history. I know for ours that it was a lot of conversation and so much prep.
Yeah.
And this is a small movie in one house. But you're dealing with an exterior, outside,
yeah, they start
in
across
line.
The street.
They start across the fucking street.
Yeah.
And I'm obsessed with Scorsese's use of camera. There's a shot in Taxi Driver that's crazy. It scandalized people when it first came out, where the camera's on De Niro walking, and then he crosses out of frame.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see the camera stays on nothing,
yeah.
rather. And then you see him enter across the street. It's like, who does that? Who lets the camera sit? So to have it start outside across the street, come in, talk to the doorman, go through that dark hallway into the light kitchen, into the slightly darker room. I can only imagine, like, they must have spent, like, you know, a full solid week just running it over and over.
Yeah, I imagine the pre-light was several days.
I can't even imagine how they worked that. I mean, I think those locations were practical.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess it's not a matter of, like, a board op. Yeah, but it's just, which I think makes it harder.
Yeah, sure.
Because it's just different things to control. So I can't remember who shot the movie.
You know, I don't know that either. I know they shot that scene 8 times.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's all one take. So I guess they just
used
the only one that worked probably would be my guess.
Yeah, but it is the best shot in the best movie of all time.
Yeah, and the blocking of it too is just amazing with all those characters. I was going to count at one point and then I just couldn't.
And you feel just like how when you feel like disgusted when Joe Pesci's bleeding out.
Yeah.
Like you feel like you want to be Lorraine Bracco. Like, you want to be with him. You know what I mean?
And that's the thing about that shot is it's not just, hey, let's show off with this long-ass tracking shot. Like,
You're entering her world.
Yeah, with no cuts, you absolutely feel what it's like. And the whole time, he's going like, it's just easier if I do it this way. It's a lot easier just to walk through here.
It's so romantic.
Yeah, it's really sweet.
It's sweet, it's romantic, it's sexy. You know what I mean? And you literally see her in the space of that scene, like, completely fall in love with him.
And, like, I know what life I'm getting into.
Yeah.
He says he's in construction.
Very soft hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she knows what she's getting into. That's why but even at the end of the day, you still feel so bad for her. Even when she's like, remember at the end when they're talking to the feds? And she's like, this doesn't involve me. And that fed's like, no, Karen, don't do the babe in the woods. I've heard you on these tapes. You know what I mean? But you still feel bad for her.
Yeah. Witness protection. I mean, and the end of that movie is, I don't know how to take it sometimes.
I mean, it's so sad to me. I always loved the little homage to the Great Train Robbery.
Yeah, I didn't realize what that was until I looked it up.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was always kind of silly to me.
Yeah.
But the more and more I watch it, the reason I love it is because you see Leota and he's sad about where he is now and he can't get decent marinara.
The blue bathrobe.
The blue bathrobe with the paper and stuff. And then it cuts that shot of Pesci pulling the gun.
Yeah,
and then
so
you
cool.
see Leota kind of like looking away with this like slight smirk.
Yeah.
And I can't decide if what we're supposed to do is he's mad about his new life, remembers his old life, and is grateful to not be in that anymore. But I think it's the opposite.
I think you're right.
I think it's him thinking about Joe Pesci killing guys, and he's like, man, that was fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he flat out says it too. Now I get to live like a schnook.
A schnook. The worst thing I ever did was become a huge Howard Stern fan because he had Henry Hill on the show all the time.
Yeah, I used to love Stern.
Yeah. And he took a little bit of the mystery out of Goodfellas, you know, where he's
that's
like,
true.
I actually have a, no kidding, I own an original Henry Hill painting.
Really?
I do. Yeah.
Some like a prison painting or?
No, he was out when he was living in Arizona or something towards the end. Or no, he moved back to New Jersey. But he would sell art. He would always go on Howard and be like, buy my art, go to henryhill.com. And a friend of mine ordered me like a piece. And
is it cool?
I mean, it's cool that he painted it.
Right.
Is it visually cool?
Does your wife let you hang it?
No,
okay.
it's rolled up.
That's the question.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I that last scene again with, or the last shot with Pesci firing the gun, it's like you said, an homage, which I didn't realize until yesterday, the Great Train Robbery.
Yeah.
But also just like, a punk rock way to end that movie.
The whole movie's punk. Like he just
feels indie still. It's nothing Hollywood about it.
No. Martin Scorsese has zero fucks to give in that movie.
Yeah.
He doesn't care. And I got to say, even though it's not as good, I remember watching Wolf of Wall Street a few years ago and being like,
I like that.
I really liked it. And it's also like, goddamn, a 71-year-old man directed this. This movie's punk rock too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's this, I like that it, you know, he did the same thing with that, which is like, the first half is like, look at all the fun they're having.
Yeah.
And the second half is like, they are disastrous.
Yeah.
But like,
sure.
He really is still to this day, like one of my favorites.
Yeah. I mean, to break the fourth wall like he did in that courtroom scene, like there's breaking the fourth wall and then doing what he did.
Having everyone freeze while your main guy gets up out of a witness bench and
just walks
talking.
The scene.
It's like, it's crazy. He breaks every rule in that movie, man. And it's just like, I've seen it 100 times and I've never not enjoyed it. I've never gotten sick of it. I always find like new little tiny tweaks here and there. That I'm just like, oh, I didn't realize that. But it is just, man.
I lived in Jersey for a few years and my friends and I used to just, it was one of these movies where it was just part of our dialogue. On the rig.
My buddy and I still like this guy's saying, what do you want from me? Like, we always say that all the time.
I'm trying to bang this broad here.
I'm trying to bang this broad. Can you believe in this day and age, a Jew broad doesn't want to go out and date an Italian?
Pesci's so good. He won the Academy Award for that.
He did. Deserved.
Yeah.
Earned.
The other one I wanted to see win, Dances with Wolves fucking swept that year, which I can't even talk about that. But I really wanted Thelma, is it Schoonmaker or Schoonmaker?
Dash, she's
his editor.
Best editor of all time.
I wanted her to win for this movie.
And Dance of the Wolves won?
Yeah, I think so.
I will say this. Dance of the Wolves is beautiful and majestic. It's just a little boring.
It's very boring.
Compared to Goodfellas.
How often do people revisit Dances with Wolves over and over 25 years later?
No. Especially not though. You might watch a scene, watch Wind in His Hair yell at him, but that's it.
All right. Well, we finished with a couple of quick segments.
Love it.
What Ebert said in 5 questions.
Oh, I love it. God Ebert. Bless.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
He gave this 4 stars. He was very much a champion of this movie.
I remember reading his review in the Sun-Times that day.
It's great. Here's a quote. Goodfellas is about guilt more than anything else, but it is not a straightforward morality play in which good is established and guilt is the appropriate reaction toward evil. No, the hero of this film feels guilty for not upholding the mafia code, guilty of the sin of betrayal, and his punishment is banishment into the witness protection program where nobody has a name and the head waiter certainly doesn't know it. What finally got to me after seeing this film, what makes it a great film, is that I understand Henry Hill's feelings. Just as his wife Karen grew so completely absorbed by the mafia inner life that its values became her own, so did the film weave a seductive spell.
Oh, my God.
Like, right on the money.
He's the best movie writer of all time.
Oh, boy. All right, then 5 questions.
Yep.
First movie you remember seeing in the theater.
Flash Gordon.
All right. The great one.
Flash!
First R-rated movie.
First R-rated movie that I saw in the theater?
Anytime.
Oh, first R-rated movie I saw, Revenge of the Nerds at a birthday party, which is crazy for a bunch of 5-year-olds to watch because you see Bush.
5. Hair pie? Thank you very much.
Hair pie.
Will you walk out of a bad movie?
I have only once or twice. There's a movie many years ago called Men of Respect starring John Turturro and I think Rod Steiger. And I was like, it was right around the time after Goodfellas came out and everyone was like, we're making a mob movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And these guys basically did like a Macbeth type of thing. And I was like, mob movie. And it's like more like Macbeth than it is Goodfellas. And I remember walking out of that. I'm trying to think. I'm sure there's one other one. But these days, no, because I could take a nap.
Right.
Which is, as a father, sleep is precious.
Yeah, yeah. I've talked about it with plenty of dads and moms in here.
Yes.
You don't take as many chances these days either.
No.
Because you only get to many movies.
You get one movie a month at the theater.
Yeah, so it's going to be good. I could take a nap. What classic movie do you wish you had been able to be in?
Ooh. Oh, wow.
Not necessarily a role, unless you want to get that specific.
Classic movie. I wonder, what year stops being classic? Like, what's the end of the classic era? Because, my favorite, old movie is, I love Paths of Glory.
Oh, sure.
That's amazing. But if I was to pick one that was a little more modern, I would have loved to have been in MASH.
Oh, man.
If I could have been Trapper or Hawkeye or one of those guys, that would have been really fun.
Big Altman fan.
Yeah, me too.
And then finally, Movie Going 101, what's your movie ritual? Where do you go? Where do you sit? What do you eat?
We have this great theater near my house called the Arclight.
I know the Arclight.
You know the Arclight?
Sure.
And, obviously now movies are few and far between, like you said, and if I do, I really have to go with my wife. But every once in a while, I need to see a movie for work, and my wife's working.
Same
so
here.
The best thing I like to do is go to the Arclight at an 11 a.m. showing.
It's the best.
It's the greatest thing in the world. You can go. We park on the roof. There are certain things that are legal now in California.
Yeah, that
so
roof.
You can maybe,
I've been to that roof.
enjoy a little bit of that. You go in. The Arclight has, I think, the best movie popcorn with real butter.
Yeah.
I get a big thing of that. If I'm really trying to be bad, I'll get a big Coke and a bottle of water. And they have just the best picture quality, the best sound. They really take care of it. No one texts. It's really movie theater for movie lovers. Mm-hmm. And I just went not too long ago with my friend, and we saw Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah.
Which I didn't think I was going to like. I was just like, oh, I'll see it. And, like, part of it was the experience, but also part of it was just the movie was adorable. And it was, like such an enjoyable morning. You know what I mean? And the best part is you walk out of that movie – and you just saw a great movie, you had a great experience, and it's like 12:49 p.m.
Yeah.
And you have the half the day left. You
can go home and work.
You're in Hollywood. You can go to Shake Shack. You can go home and write. You can do whatever you want. But that, to me, is really like the perfect time to see a movie for me. It's you know, the theater's 10% full.
Yeah.
You know, you sit anywhere you want. You can put your feet up a little bit. But that is like, that's my happy place.
All right. Good stuff, man.
Brother, man, thank you so much for having me.
I love the oath.
Thank you, man.
All right.
October 19th.
Yep. All right, everybody. Another one in the can. That was a lot of fun. Ike was a super nice guy. He filmed Blockers in Atlanta and I think Neighbors 2 in Atlanta and a couple of other things in this town. So he said he's here a lot. And on the way out, he was just like, dude, I'd love to do this again. I'll pick a different movie next time I'm here and we can hang out and talk about something else. So there may be an Ike Barinholtz part 2, everyone. It was certainly a fun time this time. And I would totally do a sequel with this guy. Very, very happy that he came in on his press tour for The Oath in theaters October 12th. Go out and support his movie. It is very, very funny and very dark. And if you are troubled by what's going on politically in this country right now, I think it's a movie you should watch because it's it sort of makes you feel a little bit better about things. Is all I'll say. I don't want to give away too much. But a very, very good movie. Check out The Oath, October 12th. Thank you to Ike Barinholtz for coming in here. And you can follow him on Twitter. Great thing when you have a name like Ike Barinholtz, that can just be your Twitter handle. So that's what it is, Ike Barinholtz. Very funny Twitter feed. So thanks a lot for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next week. And until then, just watch Goodfellas again, everybody. That's what you should do. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at HowStuffWorks Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.